Back to Cambridge, celebrating their 800th anniversary and still scoring goals. Do you remember this young man, Julian Huppert, with two Cambridge professors, both Australian as parents? He won silver for Australia in the Chemistry Olympics and gold Australia-wide, and attended Sydney Grammar for a while. His research is on four-stranded DNA.
Two-stranded is a famous structure, the Watson and Crick double helix that everybody knows about. But in some sense, that's really the shape that DNA has when it's in a crystal, when it's not doing anything. DNA, when it actually does things, is much more interesting and takes many other shapes. So in some sense, just looking at the famous double helix is a bit like looking at a suit that's just come from the dry cleaners in a plastic wrapper and saying, that's very flat, how would you fit inside? So I'm interested in these other shapes that DNA can have. And one of these in particular is where you have four strands, either four separate strands coming together, or quite often one piece of DNA knotting back on itself, so forming a sort of a lump, a bit like a knot. It's only made from certain components of DNA, so there are four bases in DNA, A, C, G, and T, and it's only made from G. When you have the right pattern of those, you get these knots. So my work has been trying to find out, where do these things form, how many knots do we have in our cells, and what do they do? One of the big challenges at the moment is we know how many genes there are. There's sort of 25,000, depending how you count them. But how are they turned on and off? How do we make sure that cells produce the right amount of something and not the wrong amount? How do cells develop? How do we make sure that an eye becomes an eye and not an ear? And this is what seems to be one of the ways that that happens. So almost half of all genes have areas which can form a knot like this, controlling whether they're turned on or whether they're turned off.
And those knots, if they go wonky, can cause cancer. Well, Julian Huppert's research is now on hold because he's just become MP for Cambridge. Lib Dem, by the way. But the work continues, led by Shankar Balasubramanian, who's the Herschel Smith Professor of Medicinal Chemistry at Cambridge. They use the fastest DNA decoders in the world to see what the cancer's made of, and so kill them. The original machines were dreamed up by Fred Sanger, the only bloke I know with two Nobel Prizes.
Well, the Human Genome Project, which involved Craig Venter, they used a chemistry that was also invented in Cambridge by Fred Sanger in the early 1980s. And that chemistry allowed thousands of people, hundreds of instruments over many years to decode the first human genome draft. Now, the way that I and my colleague David Kleinerman invented for sequencing, you can do all that in pretty much a couple of days on one instrument with part of a technician. So it speeded up sequencing by between 10 and 100,000 fold. It reduced the cost of sequencing, again about 10,000 fold. And basically, our technology has led to a billion lane sequencer. So it's changed the numbers quite dramatically.
We had Craig Venter on the Science Show a few months ago, who's making similar claims about speed. Does it mean that there are two or three different approaches to doing the same thing, or that you're more or less in parallel?
There are now a number of what are called next generation sequencing technologies. Craig Venter uses one that came out of the company Applied Biosystems, which is now part of a company called Life Technologies. That is a distinct technology from the one that we invented. It is also a very powerful, fast, cheap method of sequencing. So there is competition out there, but without wanting to brag or anything, the method that we invented is actually the world's dominating method at the moment. So for whatever reason, people are preferring to use this.
Why is making such fast sequencing important?
What rapid sequencing is being used most clinically for is to help provide the details of the genetic basis of human disease. And happy to say there is one early example of clinical decisions that have been made on the basis of sequencing the genome of a cancer patient, which I'm happy to say more about.
Yes, please, what?
Okay, so this was work done in Vancouver at the University of British Columbia in association with the cancer hospital there. It was recently published, actually. It's from the group of Mark O'Mara. And they had a cancer patient who had a cancer of the tongue, primary tumour, which metastasized, and there were secondary tumours in the lung. And they had a treatment issue because none of the conventional anti-cancer agents that they were trying against the primary tumour were effective against the secondary. So they sequenced the DNA of the primary, of the secondary, and of a normal cell type using the technology that came out of Cambridge. And they also used another way of using the sequencing to dictate the expression of all the genes in the tumour, the primary and secondary, against the normal cells. And when they looked at this information, they were able to see clusters of mutations and genetic changes in some oncogenic pathways in the secondary that were not present in the primary. And they took all this information and looked at it in terms of the biochemistry that would be affected by these genetic changes. And this helped explain why some of the drugs they had tried did not work. And it also steered them to try a specific drug that would hit these new pathways that were now operational. And the tumour got smaller within 28 days, and they were able to manage this secondary, certainly for a few more months. And then, of course, it mutated again. So what this study shows is that you could, in principle, make, well, not in principle, in reality, make clinical decisions that were not thinkable previously before such technology was invented. And in many ways, this story makes me think of the early days of HIV, when a drug would be used and the virus would mutate and become resistant. And then they'd try another drug, and then a new type of resistance would appear. And where this led to was the use of combination therapy, because they could see the resistance of the virus evolving. And they learned to understand it well enough to plug all the pathways at once with combination therapy. So one of the conclusions of this particular study in a real-life case is by understanding the evolution of a tumour in response to drugs and the acquisition of drug resistance, that it may help them come up with combination therapies that may be much more effective than current therapies.
So if you're looking at the genes of this cancer, you're really looking at ways in which it's producing proteins and therefore the chemicals, the drugs that could be used to knock off maybe this element.
Absolutely. So I think in this specific study, what it told us is that certain genes were being duplicated, and therefore these genes were collectively, the multiple copies were producing higher levels of transcripts, and that was activating a certain pathway.
Well, the implications of this approach are enormous. You could take an individual patient, sample the cancer, and see what it's doing chemically, then hit it with a killer cocktail. But would all this be affordable in the average cancer ward?
Well, you know, talking about cancer, and let's extend this to other genetically affected conditions like diabetes and predisposition to heart disease and many other diseases. And then, of course, our genetic predisposition towards certain drugs, for example, the classic antibiotics that work in some people better than others. What is emerging is a vision whereby we can stratify which medicines for which conditions are more likely to work for a given individual than another. We're not there yet. We're in the exploratory days, and I think it's going to be a decade and more before we can understand whether this could become reality and in which cases we can gain the information. But you raised a question about, can this be affordable? Well, the cost of sequencing is going down year by year, and it will soon cost no more than any other standard diagnostic test that gets done routinely for people. So I think the cost of that is not going to be the issue. So let's talk about the cost of treatment. So at the moment, if you take drugs such as cancer therapeutics, they are very, very expensive drugs. It's thousands of pounds or dollars per month. And many of them are completely ineffective at helping the patients because, for whatever reason, there's not a good match between the drug, the person, the individual, if you like.
Blunderbuss treatment.
Absolutely. So just imagine if we were able to pick out the 20% cases where a particular drug would be efficacious and not waste that resource on the 80% where it was never going to work and isn't going to help the patient. So in many respects here, one might look for efficiency savings in healthcare by actually being more effective in the treatments that we use.
Very exciting. I had no idea that this kind of DNA, RNA analysis was obeying a kind of Moore's law of doubling in power and halving in cost almost every year.
So it doesn't follow Moore's law, in fact. It exceeds it by many factors. And to give an example, taking our own technology, if we are to look at speed and cost, the reduction since the first instruments were made has been more like about fivefold per annum in terms of information generation, cost reduction and so forth. So I don't think this fivefold will continue indefinitely, but certainly since the very first next generation sequencing, the curve has been a much steeper one than Moore's law.
Exciting times, eh?
Very exciting times. This is just the beginning.
Shankar Balasubramanian is Professor of Medicinal Chemistry at Cambridge, and we could be seeing another Nobel Prize in the making with that young team. In a few minutes, the young astronomer from Swinburne University in Melbourne, who this week scored the cover of Nature with his discovery of turbulent galaxies. This is The Science Show on ABC Radio National and online at abc.net.au/rn.